This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And good afternoon, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. Appreciate you taking time with us today for another live edition of Midrats. And for those that may be new to the show, if you want to, you can scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you will find the chat room. That's a great place during the course of the show if you'd like to roll in an observation with fellow listeners, or if there's a question you would like to direct to us, that's a great way of doing it. And speaking of which, this is a free-for-all, and shocking but true, we actually have a phone number where you can call into the switchboard. And we do occasionally take callers with our regular guests, but during a free-for-all, even though my co-host and I believe we have all sorts of great questions, we're willing to take curveballs from the larger public. So if you would like to call in, you can reach us at the switchboard, area code 347-308-8397, 347-308-8397. 8397. That number is also cryptically on the show page if you want to call in. But hey, enough of that foolishness. Eagle One, good afternoon.
Hey, Sal. How are we doing today?
Well caffeinated, and we're doing all right. I got no complaints whatsoever. But at least down in the deep south, it's even though it is the second week of November officially, it's still t-shirt and shorts weather, but it is time for one of our fall free-for-alls. And just for the listener, my co-host and I, we kind of cheat in the pre-show and kind of bounce around ideas even when we have guests. But I wanted to kick something off. It's something that it has hit me before, but I really had a chance to ponder it today. Off a hunting weekend, and when we were all done, I was being driven around our property checking trail cams with one of my daughters, the one who happened to be born just a few months before September of 2001. And it just kind of hit me that I'm being driven around by somebody who has not known her nation at peace. And I looked at it for me, just looking at the span and the time frame, what that would be equivalent of for me. And I know I'm a couple of days older than you are, Eagle One, but that would be the equivalent of the middle of the Johnson administration to the Reagan inaugural, as if we were in one constant conflict, albeit a relatively low-grade one, depending upon how you measure it. That's a pretty extensive length of time. And how that generation, different than ours, though, you know, we had the Cold War during that time period. That was definitely a different creature in a variety of ways. But we also are going to have this year a batch of newly minted 05s who were commissioned at roughly the same time. And for their entire career, the dominant topic, regardless of what warfare area you're in, has been the series of operations we've had against violent expansionist radical Islam since 2001. Eagle One, just kind of roll it to you that way. I know your spawn are a few years older than me, but they are a little closer to the events that we run. What is one of the underlying things that this generation will have in their minds on how the world works and our place in it that might be slightly different from the context that we had?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because as we were discussing it earlier, I thought back. I mean, I'm I am more than a couple of days older than you. So, you know, I was, since I was born in 1949, you know, we were in the Cold War, and then that was followed almost immediately by the Korean War, which was followed, you know, and the Cold War is going along that whole time, and then followed by the Vietnam War. And, you know, there were always little actions, you know, putting troops in Dominican Republic, you know, the Bay of Pigs, the Cuban Missile Crisis, the whole, you know, I don't, you know, I guess the biggest difference I see is that not every one of those had thousands of troops, boots on the ground in some foreign country, but unless you consider the forward deployed forces, you know, guarding the Fold a Gap, in you know, place people in the Far East sometimes before Vietnam heated up, has troops on the ground. And I'm not too sure. I'm trying to figure out exactly which year we weren't at war during all that time that didn't, you know, you can look, go, gee, this, we're really at peace. And maybe it was, you know, after the Berlin Wall fell and before Desert Storm, was there a gap there?
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, how do you define peace? Because even it wasn't far, you know, while the Soviet Union was falling apart, we had Desert Storm. We had our little incident in Somalia. We had peacekeepers all over the place. But really nothing, and of course we had the Balkan flare-ups here and there, but nothing that was really a sustained effort of any scale, i.e., you know, tens of thousands of troops on the ground engaged in combat operations for year after year after year. But I think, though at times, there have been a lot of people on the ground. And I have to caveat this with the fact that through 2009, I not only was in it, I was detached from what the general public was because of where I lived. I wasn't in the U.S. for years. But the impression that I get, generally speaking, is there was and is a level of detachment from that ongoing conflict that we have that I guess perhaps we're at a point now that it's similar to than what it was in the 90s where, yeah, we had people doing small actions here and there, but it really didn't impact anybody and it really didn't break above the background noise. And I guess one indication of that, I don't know if it's war weariness or boredom or people have just gotten used to it, like an ill-fitting shoe. If you wear it long enough, eventually you don't notice it as ill-fitting. You look at the presidential election we have going right now on both the Democrat and the Republican debates and the issues. It's really not a topic of discussion. It's very, very peculiar. I don't know. I don't know if I've quite figured out whether it's that drastic of a change or if it's just a little change in the flavor of the soup, so to speak, but it's still the same.
Yeah, I ponder this all the time because I meet people who, you know, they know I have two sons in the Navy, and they go, oh, I'm sorry. You're going, no, I'm really proud of them. You know, I'm happy to have them serve, and it's a great honor that they're able to serve. And it's like they don't get it. And I'm thinking, well, how long has this been going on? And I look back, and when my dad was in the Strategic Air Command, and they were on alert all the time. I mean, they were essentially constantly on a combat footing for decades. And I say, well, you know, I wonder how many people, civilians, knew that that was the case. I mean, or how many people even on active duty today knew that that was the case, that those combat SAC crews were, you know, they were in the air all the time. They had planes constantly flying, ready to go, you know, plus all the missile, I guess we'll call them missile command, but that brings up Atari or something. You know, all those guys were ready to go, our Strategic Submarine Force, all that stuff. I mean, I feel like that's, you know, we talk about the civil military gap, but I think it began a lot further back than sometimes we give credence to today.
Yeah, I think you have a good point in that regard. I recall in the late 80s talking with a talking with a female friend of mine who made some comment, this is back in college, about how, well, you know, at least we're not under the imminent threat of any type of attack. This is, you know, sitting on the east coast of Florida. And I remember mentioning to her, like, you realize, of course, just about a 15-20 minute flight off the coast here are a bunch of Soviet ballistic missile submarines between Iceland and Bermuda that could nuke the entire eastern seaboard inside of half of a Hogan's Heroes episode. And had no idea. Now, that wasn't a national secret at the time. But, yeah, maybe a lot of what we went under in the Cold War was just maybe what we're the younger generation with this simmering conflict is. It's just part of the background noise. We've become used to it. It's that ill-fitting shoe you don't notice anymore because it's just always there. Occasionally, there will be big events that will remind everybody. But maybe it's just the new normal. What did Orwell say? We have always been at war with Oceania. We've always been at war with radical Islam. There's always been a Cold War. What will be interesting, though, is to see which conflict lasts longer.
Yeah, well, you know, as we talked before the show, the question is, are we currently in a lukewarm or tepid war or something where, you know, Russia's acting up? China, obviously, we have some issues with, but we're not at war. And it seems to me that, you know, is it a media issue where they don't cover it like war, you know, or they discount the possibility of war? I mean, I'm real confused about how we're covering Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the recapturing of, if you will, of Crimea and the threats they're making to the Baltics countries and apparently to the submarine cables, which get some play in the media, but not as much as I would think off, you know, that can run the internet throughout the world. So, you know, I have questions about where exactly we are and whether how much of this is media ignorance of what war looks like when it's fought at the stage we are now, which is kind of, you know, I'd call it jockeying for position. I mean, it's sort of like a football game where you first couple of times you have the ball, you kind of test parts of the enemy's defense to find out how they're going to respond.
I think we have a couple of issues here, one of which Scott brings up in the chat room, and that has to do with, you know, what are the American public really concerned about? They're concerned about what greets them in the face every morning. That's not a threat to their personal livelihood. It's of being able to live, but it actually is their livelihood, the economy, their ability to sustain their debt. How are their kids being educated? How come their kid that just got educated can't get a job that is appropriate to what they've invested in the education? How secure is their job? What does their retirement look like? Are they still underwater in their house? Now, you know, those are the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and maybe because of the areas of interest that we have and the background that we have, we pay more attention to national security issues than maybe other people really think is that important. And I think the second part of that is, where do people get their information from? The media. You brought up the media. One of the big disappointments of the last decade and a half for me is I naively thought after we got towards the middle to the end part of the last decade that we had been at war for so long. And especially in the 2006, 7, 8, 9 time frame, the Iraq and growing in Afghanistan, greater interest, that we would see more people in the media who had experience as war correspondents. There are some of the people that we recall from the early part of the invasions of Iraq, especially, who were embedded with troops. And these same reporters, when you do see them, they're not covering national security issues anymore. There have been some great documentary filmmakers, and we've had a few of them that we've interviewed on the show, that I would love to see some major network to have on their staff that know the difference. And it's those who inform the general public by either design or benign neglect have decided they don't need that expertise inside their lifelines to help inform the public. And if you don't have somebody in the decision-making matrix that says we have 20 to 25 minutes of time to fill, what are we going to fill it with? We have these following 12 topics. Well, these 12 topics, we can fit five in there. Okay, which of the five topics we have people that will not sound like a fool in the air about? Okay, do. And if you're not populated with people who have knowledge, then you're not going to talk about it much. So that's one of the big disappointments. I thought that we would have a new cadre of people in the media that would have the background to be able to give the nuance and to explain what we're doing a little better. I guess the closest we got to that was Brian Williams, and he made up half of his crap, so that didn't help us too much.
Yeah, I was fascinated by. I mean, we do a lot of stuff on maritime security. I was fascinated when we had Ian Urbina on the show, because he did the New York Times series on the outlaw ocean stuff.
Yeah,
and it was the first time, I swear, that people I knew ever knew that there was, like, well, wait a minute, we have people at sea on ships and bringing goods around the world, and a lot of people live in really bad conditions, and you're sitting there going, how sheltered a life do you lead, where you don't have to worry about things like, I'm going to put goods on a ship here and get it someplace else, and even after all the years of Somali piracy, people are still clueless as to why that was a threat, and you got to wonder why. I mean, I guess it's what you said. They have other things in their life to them are far more important than worrying about these concerns, and it's somebody else's problem, and maybe that's the issue.
Yeah, things are just going to have to get worse before anybody really gets concerned with them. And let's kind of shift over to another topic, but along a similar vein. There are these things, and you mentioned Russia and what they've done in Ukraine, which, by the way, is a pretty amazing thing when you think about it. Ukraine is not within the lifelines of an alliance. They're one of the more challenging of the Eastern European countries, trying to get through the corruption and the fractured society that came out of all former Soviet republics, with the exception of the Baltics, that did a pretty good recovery, but that's a cultural issue that maybe is a different show with a guest who's got some confidence in it. But the Russians have done something pretty impressive with very little expenditure of personnel, have taken the Crimea, have taken the southeastern part of Ukraine. One of the more insightful things, I think we talked about it a little bit last time we had Dmitry on, is the thought was, well, we'll put in some economic sanctions against the Russians, and once their oligarchs can only buy two Ferraris as opposed to four, they'll be squealing and they'll throw Putin out. Really was underestimating the Russian character and the power of their own national mythology, and to be blunt, the Russians' ability to take pain. And if somebody think that is really going to make the Russian psyche squeal, probably need to read a little more Russian literature going back a couple of centuries to get a vibe on what that's going to do. And in Syria, with the Russian involvement, I've been waiting to see something from the present administration to really grasp what I think is obvious in here, that Russia isn't our enemy in Syria. If you want to really look at our national interest and that of Western Europe, The largest threat in that area is ISIS and the Islamic State. The only thing that's stopping the Islamic State and in a popular front uprising, these other fundamentalist Islamic, quote, rebels, unquote, would all be subsumed by the Islamic State once the Assad regime fell. It is the Assad regime, which I'm no fan of, but I don't know if that's a dragon we need to slay. So if Russia is there to prop up Syria, mostly Assad, and they've got to go after the non-Islamic State rebel units because they happen to be the ones that are closest to the Syrian government positions. I don't understand why we really should do anything to get in Russia's way. I think the argument could be made that if you have two possible outcomes in Syria, first of all, let's wall the Kurds off. The Kurds will smooth up the edges of what they think they can defend in their traditional areas and their mountain strongholds. They're not going to go in. You're not going to see a Kurdish army marching around. That entering argument, you have one of two choices. Either the Assad regime survives and comes to some accommodation with the Kurds, and at that point, almost like the pit of a fruit, the Islamic State gets squirted into western Iraq, which is a different subject, or the Islamic State wins. The Islamic State manages to take out Assad. You will see a refugee crisis that will make the present, you know, march of a million military-aged men through Western Europe seem like a holiday jaunt, because every ethnic minority and religious minority is going to be in danger, because the Islamic State's been very clear about what they'll do. If you're Sunni Muslim and you're willing to fall in line, you'll probably be okay, unless you happen to be gay or like museums and stuff like that. If you're a Shia, you're dead. If you're a Christian, you might live if you pay the tax and after we take your daughters. If you're a Yazidi, if you're a Druze, if you're one of the more obscure Shia sects, you're dead. So those people are going to leave. What's the worst case scenario? If Assad pushes the Islamic State back, or the Islamic State goes all the way to the Mediterranean, because they're not going to stop there. So if Russia is willing to put boots on the ground and ordnance on target, I think like I outlined a while ago, why not let them have at it? We'll hit the Islamic State in Iraq and eastern Syria. Let the Russians have the West. We can worry about the rest in the middle. What are your thoughts on this, Eagle One? Am I really not catching something here? Because I almost feel like we are doing what we accuse others of doing, which is we have a reflexive response. Russia's over here, so we need to be on the other side. If FDR can make accommodation with the Soviets, we could probably make accommodations, however distasteful, with Russia and their proxies, irrespective of Iran being involved or not.
Yeah, I don't think. I mean, the trouble with working with Russia is that you got to work with Russia, and
yeah.
As much as I like to believe that they have, you know, if they're just going to prop up Assad and leave, fine. If they really want to keep their warm water port in Syria, you know, and maybe expand it, you know, I can kind of live with that, because I think their navy is such a joke that it really doesn't bother me that much. But you know, what is Russia's end game in this? And that's a question we've got to ask. You know, and what happens if they do keep Assad in power? I mean, what kind of nasty retribution will he bring to the people who have resisted his regime? You know, what are the Turks up to? Because you're talking about walling off the Kurds.
Eagle One, you there?
You hear me?
Ah, yeah, there.
Nope.
Yeah, last I heard was wall off the Kurds, and then we had a dead mic.
Okay, well, you say wall off the Kurds, and I'm saying you know, the Turks are the resisting, going to resist that because they have their own issues with the Kurds brought about by Kurdish terrorist groups like the PKK. So, you know, none of this is clean. This is one of these wheels within wheels sort of problems. And, you know, and we all know that those are intractable. And the question I have, I mean, we'll go back to this is kind of a political issue, but if we had not withdrawn our forces from Iraq rather precipitously, would we even be in this position now where we have to worry about this stuff? And does that matter at this point, or is it just that's just water under the bridge? And is the current administration going to try and kick this football down the road until the next administration takes over?
Ding, 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 ding. That's two things that I've heard. First of all, the advantage of having, of not leaving Iraq prematurely like we did, and people warned of this at the time, it shouldn't be a surprise to anybody. If they had been in place, it would have been the intelligence assets of being able to detect the Islamic State as they started to work their way through the Syrian border coming to the southeast. It could have stopped them from penetrating as far as they had. But, yeah, that's water under the bridge. I do think the other item that I've heard, and I've been hearing this a lot over the last few years, 2 years or so, and I think it's accurate. Much of President Obama's policy is to have a holding action to let other people solve it. He really does not want to have anything to do as a wartime president. He's very risk adverse. I think former Secretary of Defense Gates said it best about Joe Biden. He's been wrong about every major foreign policy event for the last two decades. Joe Biden is constantly in his ear. There are other problematic members of his advising staff in the national security arena. He's just pushing down the road, avoid decisions. But I think by intention or not, I think a lot of the decisions, it's going to be too late to change things. And whoever the next president is going to have very limited options on what he can or should do, because history doesn't take a pause for your next election. The truth change, environment change, and the calculus will change about whether you do something or not. And I think that's probably what we are going to see, regardless of what the next president may or may not want to do. He's got very limited options because it wasn't done years ahead of time. And to kind of bring the wheel back to where we started our free-for-all today, I don't think the American public wants anything to do with it, whether it's the right thing to do or not. And especially if the next president has an R by their name, the minute they step in that direction, all the usual suspects you haven't seen in the last 8 years are going to come out of the woodwork with their big puppets and their Guido Fawkes masks, and it's going to be the media will wake up. It'll be a complete zoo. I just don't see, barring, unfortunately, thousands of dead American civilians one afternoon on something that could have been prevented, where the American public are going to want to turn into the wind again. I think they're very happy going with following seas.
Yeah, and I wonder, well, I mean, we haven't even mentioned Iran in this mess either, so, and the policy of this administration toward Iran and what that leads to. But, you know, the problem with this scenario of several thousand dead Americans down the road is that it's always the administration that is in the office at the time that catches the heat for what happened, regardless of what happened in the administrations, maybe one or two administrations before them that set the dominoes in motion. You think of Bill Clinton and his lackluster efforts to get bin Laden and, if you even want to call them that, but you know, I was on a ship in the Far East when he was getting ready to be subpoenaed. The next thing we knew, they'd launched a bunch of cruise missiles to in the middle of Afghanistan. Everybody's looking around, going, gee, I wonder why we did that. So, you know, it's enough to make you cynical, cynical sometimes. And the movie that night,
yeah,
by the way, was the movie that night was I forgot the name of the movie, but it was the one where the president fomented a war or something to get out of
wag the dog.
Wag the dog, exactly. You know, which was perfect timing.
Yeah, there were lots of interesting things about the Clinton administration that people don't like talking about, but ultimately you have to take the world as it comes to you, which, you know, before we leave the Syria mess, which I still think my recommendation, and I'm not the only one to come up with it, if you want to understand Syria, watch Game of Thrones. Because nobody can figure out what the hell is going on in Game of Thrones either, so you don't give up on Syria. It's just about as convoluted.
If you do get involved, I mean, we have to go back to the history of every other war anybody's ever fought, which is if you do get involved, you can't just sit there and go, well, we're gonna, you know, you got to go in with the idea that there is some end state you want to end up with, not just, you know, it's a holding action or, you know, whatever. And it may be said that if President Obama's view of the world is such that he thinks we stuck our nose into places where we didn't really need to be, and let these people kill each other, and God will sort out how it works. Maybe that is a strategy, just not a well articulated one.
Right, and I don't know how well it works in the 21st century, though. It does, on occasion, it does seem as if all of our traditional allies have other things they want to worry about. But before we leave the Syria, Paul over in the chat room, you know, brought up an interesting point. The pot that's percolating on the back of the stove is a Russian airliner that appears possibly to have been taken down by a bomb, which, you know, I don't think you have the best security in the airports in Egypt. The Russians have an interesting history when it comes to people who do things like that to them. The Russian response tends to be extremely destructive, almost medieval, and leaves no question about what happens when people do this to Russia. How could the Russians manifest a traditional Russian response if it does turn out that this was an Islamic state or one of the terrorist organizations' attacks? You know, one of the things that came to my mind is something that I kind of thought would be nice for us to do on occasion. Go back to what we did in Vietnam with our B-52s. The Islamic State has a capital, Raqqa. Besides the U.S., Russia has a lot of heavy bombers, and they have lots of dumb bombs. 4 or 5 three-ship flights of heavy bombers over Raqqa could really make a point, but I don't know whether the Russians would go the Chechnya route in that regard. What are your thoughts on Russia's options here, or do you think they might do something, being that they've been making a habit of this recently, do what people don't expect them to do, which is nothing?
Well, I mean, you're going to – one of the problems with Russia is, what is their strength right now? I mean, we're seeing bears. I mean, bears have been around since I was a knee-high to a pup. I mean, those are old airplanes. And
yeah.
Do they have new bombers? You know, what is the real status of their forces? And I just don't think this is just a casual observation, not based on in-depth look at this stuff, but I don't think they're as strong as everybody thinks they are. You know, they may be able to roll over Ukraine, but Ukraine doesn't have a whole lot going for it either. So I'm not sure where Russia's strength is. Maybe in submarines, but, you know, I'm not – what would they do? I think in the old days they might have tried to pound ISIS into dust, but I don't know if they can do that. I mean, they're have the same problem everybody else has. They're fighting if they get on the ground in a country that's far away from home, how do you get your troops there? How do you sustain your troops? Do they have the wherewithal to fight a long-term action? Do they have enough bombs? all that stuff. You know, and if you look at their, we talked a little bit about the pre-show, but if you look at their cruise missile attack, you know, everybody goes, "Ooh, they got cruise missiles too." But you know, how many of those actually hit anything, and how many ended up landing in Iran?
Yeah, there's a theory, and I think it's probably spot on, that what we're seeing in Syria right now is Russia is taking, you know, former readiness officers will know what I mean. They're taking their C-1 units. They're deploying their high readiness units. But they don't have other units that are going to be C-1 or C-2 in 6 months to replace them. And so they're running through their best of their best and kind of Potemkin villaging the rest. So that is one possibility, because they're not a rich country, and they're really not that bad. They've got their own demographics problems. Maybe they're hoping to leverage their experience with a new relationship that we've helped them develop with the Iranians, and let the Iranian and the Hezbollah forces do the work on the ground while Russia does the higher brain function stuff from the air. And speaking of, when I was looking at an article that came out this weekend talking about our allies or lack of allied participation in the air war in Syria and Iraq, you know, the Canadians are, after their election, are going home, which a free people are allowed to elect people to want to do that, and they've done that before. Other allies do not want to do like we've done and deploy to Incirlik in Turkey, which gives us closer access to Syria. And our Gulf Arab allies, their high readiness units, they're all fighting the war that nobody's covering at all. Again, going back to a topic we talked about earlier on the show, and that's against the am I pronouncing it correctly, Houthi rebels in Yemen, because we have another Shia Sunni proxy war going on down there. There's a lot of the Gulf Arabs, and I believe the Jordanians as well, are following the lead Sunni power, i.e. Saudi Arabia, in going after the Shia Houthi rebels in Yemen, which is a whole other demographic, economic mess down there as well. So I guess the old operating area of T.S. Lawrence, the north and the south, are both engaged in a Shia-Sunni proxy war, which in many ways I would presume you could say is just another chapter of a book that's been going on for the better part of 1,300 years.
Yeah, if the only way you can stop those forces from killing each other is to have dictators who kill people on both sides, that seems like a rather difficult, you know, that argues against replacing Saddam and Assad and all these other guys. You want a strong man in place. You know, back in the days when Ataturk turned Turkey secular, part of the effort was to stop this internecine warfare. And it lasted for a while, but, you know, the current administration in Turkey, Erdogan, seems to be willing to bring it all back. So,
yeah, I think we're in a waxing phase of that level of sectarianism. And unfortunately, and we'll just use the European medieval version of that until we got through the wars of religion, 30 years war and things of that manner, that they just have to get through slaughtering each other. They have to both sides reach a point of exhaustion, or one person just utterly annihilates the other one. And there was a really interesting article years ago that was kind of critiquing the comparison of what goes on in the Arab / Islamic Persian world in a Western context, like I just did, because of their experience with the Mongols. When you look at not just the Mongols, but you also had other variations of the theme, like Tamerlane, annihilation is the given. You don't just take a town and its inhabitants like they did in Samarkand. You take the town, you behead 25,000 people, and then you move on to the next town until they surrender without a shot. You do what Genghis Khan did when the people in the central Bamiyan Valley of Afghanistan put an arrow through the throat of his grandson. You kill every man, woman, child, and goat in the entire valley and repopulate with your people. So there might not be a point where they fight to exhaustion, but they will fight to annihilation unless they have something like the old Ottoman Empire that would kill everybody if they didn't calm down because they wanted order so much, which is the only reason why you have all these religious minorities that still exist to this day, is the Ottomans tolerated them. I don't think we're reaching a point of moving towards more tolerance in that part of the world, but towards less tolerance, and that just means conflict, which I guess begs the question, what's in our interest to get involved and try to shape it to the direction we want to, or to disengage and contain? Do we need a containment theory for this latest series of conflicts?
Well, and that goes back to the question earlier, you know, is Obama's theory to do that, just keep us out of this mess, you know, and but the problem with containment is how do you contain this? I mean, if everybody runs away, all the people who know they're in danger, you know, runs to Europe, and is that going to leave them smoldering where they want to go back and take back the homeland, or are they really going to, you know, this that we've talked about assimilation issues and all that before. You know, where exactly does that leave Europe? I mean, are they suddenly going to have a very large minority, or perhaps even the way the demographics go, a majority, which will put them back in the middle of this sort of mess and bring it to Sweden instead of Syria?
Well, they've shown in the past that there's very little assimilation that goes on in Western Europe, and those that have lived there have seen it. I think what's a little different about this latest wave is I've seen two figures. It's probably somewhere between the two. 75 to 85% of the hundreds of thousands that are marching on Europe right now are military-age young men. Military-age young men who do not have women with them, do not have children with them, when they go someplace else, and they also don't have language skills, they don't have marketable work skills in economies that are already, when you look at youth unemployment in Western Europe, especially for young males, it's unprecedented levels of unemployment and underemployment there. You're going to have a significant change in Europe in a few ways. One, it's first of all, the demographics, if they stay and they show no inclination of wanting to come back, go back to where they came from, then there's also the problem of a bunch of unemployed, unassimilated young men let loose on the countryside. Nowhere in human history does that come out well from a crime point of view, from a rape point of view, from an economic point of view. Europe is going to have to find a way to extract. I think what also should lead one to be more pessimistic and optimistic, if you look at where they're going, are these people who are going to places of refuge, are they going someplace to live off the fat of the land? They're moving to Sweden, they're moving to Germany, they're moving to those countries that are still living in a fantasy land and are offering significant benefits. They're not going there. They're not going to where the work is. They're going to where they can get free money. So that's going to cause Europe to change in another way. You cannot, in the days of modern travel and open borders, you cannot have an attractive welfare system that goes beyond even what was envisioned by Bismarck. If you're going to cut off and let that less attractive, then what do you do with those who have already showed up? What are you going to do when you have, like we saw in Eastern Germany, a town of 100 that are going to be housing 700 people of a foreign culture coming from the Middle East and South Asia? 80% of them are unattached males of military age, and you get your typical Brandenburg winter. How many cycles do you go through till people start becoming a problem? And we've already seen reports of thousands that have been registered and who have disappeared. Well, we all know where they're going to. They're going to Hamburg. They're going to Frankfurt. They're going to Rotterdam. They're going to try to make their way to the upper Midlands of the UK, where they already have, they're going to France, where you already have these subcultures within cultures where these people can disappear. Where does it go from here? I don't know, but I don't think they're going to open a bunch of doner kebab shops. That market's already saturated. So this, you know, secondary effect of the conflict that's going on in Syria, if you do disengage, which everybody seems to want to do, and this expands, if you don't support Russia and the Islamic State takes Syria, they're not going to stop. They'll go into Lebanon. They'll go south into Jordan. They'll take more of non-Kurdish Iraq until they come up against the Iranians somewhere southeast of Baghdad. This will new pulses, new waves of refugees. If you look at the demographic, especially in Yemen, that wave come on. What happens if they expand their small footprints in Syria and the Sinai and start to push on the already fragile Egyptian government? There's another pulse. Egypt's a huge nation. Another pulse and a wave. How many more waves can Western Europe have before it fundamentally changes one way or the other? The next few years in that is just going to be fascinating to watch. And if you visit Europe, you might not want to stay in the big cities.
Yeah, you know, somewhere, I guess somebody's writing the history of how Europe got into this mess to begin with by, you know, what happened after World War One to the Middle East. And the divisions that were created artificially. How about changing the topic absolutely completely? What do you think the biggest naval maritime story was this year so far?
Well, the biggest maritime story this year. One's obvious, and one I think seems obvious, but we have to wait for two more cards to pull out. I think the biggest maritime story, because it brings in the tactical, the operational, the strategic, brings in the legal side of the house. Plus, it just opens the door to all sorts of mischief around the globe if people want to. It's what the Chinese are trying to do in the South China Sea. What happens when you create artificial land and claim it as your own? And invite somebody to do something about it. Who's playing the higher stakes poker? Who's holding the stronger hand? I don't think we really know that. I think people on both sides are overestimating their hand. And I think people on both sides are underestimating their opponent's hand. I think regardless of what direction we go here, there's going to be a significant change. If the Chinese get away with doing what they want to do, again, with modern technology and funding and motivation, there's quite a few places on the globe where you can create sovereign territory and make it yours and invite people to do something about it. The international community and the legal beagles maybe need to quit having so many panels and nice vacation spots and start to make some policy that will stick without spending 3 or 4 years to do it in 2,000 pages. Or I think in that particular area in the maritime world, you're not only going to create a lot of friction, but you will unnecessarily, through the injection of the unknown and insecurity, you're creating opportunity for conflict that is really unnecessary in a larger extent. And I think the other story is one that was just a matter of time with technology. And you alluded to it earlier, the From the unlikely location of the Caspian Sea, the Russians breaking the seal on their land attack cruise missiles. You know, we had a learning curve with them. They will. Other nations, as they develop them, will as well. These one-way drones, so to speak, is the technology is there, portable, and with modern computers, not that difficult to do. How much more will Russia use this technology? And what other nations will start to get this technology and use the same template that the United States has created in their use? We've been pretty pretty liberal in our use of land attack cruise missiles to the point that other nations can use them as well, and there's really not much we can complain about them in most venues. So those are my two big naval issues of the year, mostly because they're not over and done with. They're actually just beginning, and I think that they're going to be ongoing stories over the course of the next few years. How about yourself?
Those issues, and I see an underlying issue which really disturbs me, and that has to do with the size of our fleet and the nature of the ships that we have. I think it's becoming more and more evident that we don't have enough ships. I don't care how capable any individual ship is. And we're adding, the ships we are adding, as you've pointed out repeatedly over the years, these LCS, whatever they are now, frigates, are as currently configured, not the ones we're selling to the Saudis, are incapable of providing any kind of assurance to our allies that they're anything more than a speed bump on the road to China taking over the South China Sea. So I see that as the biggest underlying issue: the number of ships, the size of our fleet itself, the capabilities of the ships that are in the fleet, and you know, the best example of that recently is the fact that we did not have an aircraft carrier operating in the Arabian Gulf / Persian Gulf recently because we don't have enough aircraft carriers. So, and the argument that, yeah, we have fewer ships, but they're each more capable, doesn't really have the impact when a ship can only be one place at a time. And even if it's a really competent ship, how many really competent ships does it take to replace a whole bunch of less competent but still pretty good ships, and where do we go from there? And I see that Scott has asked the question, should we still build big deck carriers or should we start building smaller ones? I think we've discussed this before, and I tend to agree with the people who say that a big deck carrier offers you significant advantages of scale that small carriers don't. But having said that, we need to really look seriously at using the small carriers we do have much more efficiently.
Yeah, I like the small carriers, the big carriers. I think when the F-35 comes along, it'll be interesting to see how we play with that. And speaking of small carriers, we do have a caller. Somebody took us up on our offer. And we'll go ahead and bring them on. Area code 202, you're on Midrash. You have a question for my co-host and I.
Hey, thanks for letting me join us. I'll call myself Commander Cal. I had an inspiration with Commander Salamander when I took over as an O5 in the Pentagon and started reading your blog. So thanks a lot for all you guys do online. Hey, quick question. In Britain, there's a row. General Houghton said that the labor leader's stance on Trident and nuclear weapons undermined their credibility to deterrence. And I'm kind of curious, having the Ministry of Defense critiquing openly a civilian leader, if obviously they have different laws than we do, but could you see something like that happening at senior levels in our military?
Eagle One, you want to take that, and then I'll follow up?
Yeah, I was going to say, only if they start growing some things that sometimes they don't have. I mean, it's a tough issue for us because you're right. It's there is a legal thing, but I'm not sure that that you can't couch it in a way, perhaps the gentleman, you know, doesn't understand the issue. And if you're that senior, every now and then somebody, one of these guys is going to have to take a stand to be strong enough to accept the fact he may get fired. You know, they're not going to take him out and shoot him. They're just going to fire him. So I would really hope that there is some somebody with the wherewithal to do that if they really see it as a major issue.
Yeah, I agree with Eagle One on this. Is you reach a point, you know, somebody's got to put a marker down there. I think there's a couple of great examples out there. They're not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but you can look at Bright Shining Lie. You can look at McMaster's work as well. Dereliction of Duty. I had trouble pulling that out of my head all of a sudden. But if you have three or four stars on your shoulder and there is something that everybody knows in this line of work, and you do it in a calm and respectful but direct manner, if you get fired, fine. You're going to be making six figures in retirement anyway, but you've done your nation and your service what they're paying you for. It's one thing to have a couple of retired mid-grade officers making points, but an active duty person saying something, even though it is directed at a political party, if the political party or a politician themselves is making a point about national security, I think it's fair game, especially if they're not your commander-in-chief. And if you're asked a question, you know, obviously I think it'd be inappropriate to get up on the stage at a national convention of the opposing party. But if you're asked a question by a reporter, or you pen an op-ed and you do it right, I think it's important to put a marker out there because it advances the conversation. And that, unfortunately, Commander Kay, what you're touching on here is a topic that has concerned me for quite a while. It's you're not having a conversation if only one side speaks, only one opinion comes out. That's not a conversation. That's a lecture. And in the national security and the military arena, when you have a culture that allows just one side to be spoken, where people take advantage of what is very true, when you're working for a commander, you come in behind the closed door, the commander asks for certain recommendations, he picks one, the door opens, even if you disagree, you come out, you execute the commander's orders. That's the right thing to do, that's the correct thing to do. That's different than opinion, discussion, and development. And there's a tendency to confuse the two. So I hope our friend across the water doesn't get hammered too hard for what he's done, because it will advance the conversation, and it will also make sure that politicians of all stripes, before they make comments about national security issues, that they have good advisors and they're willing to answer the follow-on question, so to speak. Did that get to the point that you wanted?
Yeah, perfectly. Thank you very much.
Okay. Hey, appreciate the call. And Eagle One, we're coming up here on just a few more minutes on our free-for-all. Been going rather quickly. Were there any?
I got a question for you. Okay. We talked about the size of the fleet. We talked about the kind of ships we have. And you're operational planning type, where I was just, you know, not. And what? And this is here. You got a whole minute, less than a minute, to answer this. What constraints on doing the kind of planning you did? Was the size of the fleet and the nature of the ships you have? What constraints does that put on what you look at when you're doing the planning?
Sustainability. If you need to kick in the door, and you know you have X number of units available for Y amount of time, you better damn sure have your branch plans in if your timeline doesn't work. Because if you don't have a big enough fleet, you're only going to be able to have sustained operations for a few days. If you got, you know, you look at what we did with Desert Fox, with one carrier, and we had the second carrier come in line, and we were able to do it, we had to quit. if you don't have a big enough fleet, you don't have the endurance for the run. All you can do is kick in the door and hope things work out. Hope isn't a plan. You've got to have your branch plans. You've got to have your homework right. A small fleet limits the commander-in-chief's flexibility on what he needs to do and also when you can do it. If you don't have what you need in place, you've got to bring it in. Is that going to be 2 weeks, 2 months, or 2 years? It all depends upon how much you have in your ready locker. Smaller fleet, less flexibility. If you have less flexibility, you have fewer options to nip something in the bud when it's small, and then by the time you're ready to do something, it's already gotten much larger.
Good answer.
Hey, I tapped in. But, hey, I guess that gives us we're already in the after show, which is fine. Anything that you are looking towards next year that our listeners might be able to help to scare up just the right guest to talk about?
Actually, we were fortunate enough to be able to host a young Australian officer the last couple of days. And we started talking about the Battle of the Coral Sea and the effect that a relationship with Australia, probably our best ally and certainly been involved with us in more wars than almost anybody else in recent memory, on our side. And probably going to look, we need to really discuss the ally situation in the South China Sea region and in, the area of Australia and some of those other countries around there. So I think I'll be looking at that down the road. I think this Syria mess, I mean, it is, and this is probably no longer politically correct to say, but it is a tar baby to end all tar babies for those of us who grew up reading Joel Chandler Harris. So I'm sure we're going to hear a lot more about that. And then I'm concerned, the fleet is too small now, but you can't build a fleet overnight. So where should we be going with this stuff? And I'm sure those are topics we'll be addressing as we go down the road.
Yep, we sure don't have a mothball fleet anymore. No, I think you've hit on the bold-faced items there. And I think we give our listeners here a little homework. Find us a good guest for the Australia to Korea corridor. How about that? Talk about our allies. Talk about our friends. Because I think you're right, especially Australia. People forget not just in World War II, but they fought with us in Korea, and they fought with us in Vietnam. They fought with us in Afghanistan. They fought with us in Iraq. And they fought in Desert Storm, and they're flying with us right now. They have a few aircraft that are contributing to our MAX line. So
good fellow folks, good blood of blokes,
and got a couple Liberty stories, but I'll keep it to myself. Thank you very much, Eagle One. And a reminder to our listeners, next week we'll have on Claude Berube to discuss his latest novel, Siren Song. So we will talk to everybody next week. Until then, have a great Navy Day, Eagle One.
Have a good week.
Molly wrote a neat reply to Iris Padion, saying Mike Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly, farewell, Leicester Square. It's a long, long way to Tipperary.